You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. The Radio Cafe is brought to you today by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. After a warm winter with lots of beautiful blue skies but very little moisture, the city is calling on its residents to renew our water conservation efforts. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the new online water quiz and learn how to save water and contribute long-term to keeping Santa Fe green and healthy. You'll also find out how to earn hundreds and even thousands of dollars by making your home and workplace more water-wise. That's facebook.com/savewatersantafe. And thanks to the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. And by the way, if you want to sponsor the Radio Cafe, you can contact Henry Lopez. His email is hlopez@sfnewmexican.com. You can also call 505-986-3054, or you can go to radiocafe.org and click on New Mexican and find all that information there. And now to our program. I'd like to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Dr. Andrew Lustig. He's founder and president of Global Outreach Doctors. And joining us by Skype is Tyler Jones. He's vice president of operations for Global Outreach Doctors. He's a nurse, he's a fireman, and he's on his way to Bangladesh, which we will be talking about in a moment. Welcome, both of you, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Awesome. Great to be here.
Thank you for having me.
So, we are talking about refugee camps in Bangladesh where Rohingya Muslims have been landing. They've been fleeing persecution from their home country of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. They're going to Bangladesh where they land in these refugee camps. They're basically stateless, even though they've been living in this region forever. It's a complicated history that deserves its own completely other show on the history of this. But they are in rough shape. They land in Bangladesh. What are these places like that they land, these refugee camps?
So the initial, when they come across, they travel to the border at this river crossing. It's basically, there's no trees, no shelter from the heat. It's really brutal at that crossing where they kind of process all the refugees. So when we were out there, we tried to set up like coverage. A lot of them have traveled a long distance. So we try and get them some water and immediate medical. If anybody that was out there has wounds from the military, the Myanmar military, we treat those. And then from there, they will be either transported or walk to the refugee camps, which are a little deeper in the country. And they're thousands of acres deep. The major issue right now is those refugee camps are in kind of a flood zone. They get a lot of cyclones every year. So over the years, the water's carved out these steep kind of sheer drop-offs, hillsides, things like that. As well as when they get there, the first thing they do is build shelters and create fires for wood, for food, for kind of warmth to cook. So basically, this entire camp is just a muddy, desolate hillside that they live on. There's no, you know, no vegetation, and it's all very kind of steep and dangerous.
So do you have children slipping off the cliffs and stuff like that?
Oh, it's horrible. So when I got out there, my first reasoning of going back out, my first goal was, so we set up these clinics on the outside perimeters because it's so difficult to hike deep into these camps. It's just it's a lot of work. You have your medical supplies, and it's extremely hot. So there's not a lot of medical providers that want to do that. My goal was to come back out and hike deep into these camps and treat the people where they are. Because while we were out there doing the clinics, we'd have elderly people, postpartum hemorrhaging women. They would be a 40, 50-minute hike into the camp, and they would have five people grabbing them by the arms and legs and kind of just dragging them out to the clinics. Just horrible stuff. And they would drop them. I mean, it's just kind of a really rough area. And so I wanted to hike in there with our medical supplies, treat people within the camp, and then if anybody's really sick, we would actually facilitate extricating them out to the perimeter roads and getting help. Kind of like a refugee camp EMS system, if you would.
Just to give the listeners a little bit of an idea of the background, there are 1 million Rohingya refugees living in Myanmar before 2017, but in October of 2017, there were something like 700,000 of them that fled to Bangladesh, and the numbers went up. We were in Bangladesh several months ago in the first quarter of 2018, and at that time, the crisis of hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing basically genocide was very acute and happening right then. Since then, the UN and the UNHCR have set up major facilities. One is called the Cox's Bazar, and have outfitted Cox's Bazar with the ability to provide clean water and latrines and all of that, and sort of keep any kind of cholera outbreak at a minimum. You know, this is a crisis that's been compared to apartheid. And so I want to first sort of let people know that, you know, an entire population of 1 million people, that 75% of them have left because of the threat of genocide. And so that's the setup. And that's why such large volumes in such a short period of time have fled the border. And that creates a crisis in a proportion that you have to deal with that many people. So there are major medical providers, obviously the UN, UNHCR, and all of the major NGOs are there to deal with the sheer volume. And in terms of our first trip, it was to be there, and things were sort of unsettled. I mean, those agencies come in with massive resources, but still takes them time to set up. Now, our return trip, a lot of those protocols and a lot of the areas that were sort of in the gaps that weren't being treated, you know, perhaps children, schooling for children, and, you know, variety of other services are now well established. But we're also in the monsoon season, and so now we're dealing with flooding and backup of human waste and all kinds of other issues which could lead to disease.
And just to clarify, the water and the sewage has never been solved. It's horrific there. They drill really shallow wells that have been tested positive for arsenic. And they also, because of the drainage and everything, the sewage runs off into it as well. The sanitation there is absolutely atrocious. Access to clean water is almost non-existent because of the fact that you would have to drill so deep for the wells. All of the sewage runoff, everything is contaminating the water supplies. They're absolutely overwhelmed as far as the water. And like Andrew said, now, whatever infrastructure was in place is destroyed because of this flooding. The homes that were built on these sharp cliff edges and things are all washed out. People are being stranded in locations.
Right. There's something like, I think in June it was reported by UNICEF, there's like 1,000 shelters and hundreds of latrines that were damaged. And so that speaks to what Tyler's talking about.
Yeah, even when there wasn't any flooding, those latrines and those wells were horrifically inadequate.
And so, what kind of health problems are you seeing as a result of those inadequate water and sewage systems?
Yeah, a lot of the typical illnesses, like Andrew was saying, with the cholera, with GI issues, we're getting a lot of just infection, sanitation types of infections, eye infections, abdominal, stomach types of issues. There's a lot of education that also kind of has to take place on those, as well as like malnutrition. I mean, These people just don't have adequate hydration. I mean, all the vegetation's gone, so they're exposed to this extreme heat. They're hiking great distances to get to any food that's available. Yeah, dehydration, malnutrition.
One of the things that you're doing out there is bringing water filtration systems. Tell us more about that, Tyler.
So before I got out there, I'd kind of spoken with some people, and I did a crowdfunding to collect what's called a life straw. It's basically a personal water filter. You can dip it directly into any kind of filthy water, and it will filter it out. You can drink directly from a puddle. The people that invented it have actually said that they've used it on sewage and been able to drink clean water. And it provides, I believe, 10,000 gallons over the life of this straw. And they're $20 each. We got them on a discount for 15. So we were distributing those out there so that they could keep them with them. They're portable. There's also filters that I brought for women because they do have formula for children. A lot of the women that were pregnant, unfortunately, in this situation, were raped, a lot of women and girls. So there are an unfortunate amount of women that have children secondary to this situation. The nutrition for those children is a big issue. So one of the filters, you can filter the water to make formula for the babies as well. And so those two filters are things that we were trying desperately to kind of distribute. We did a crowdfunding and raised as many as we could. I think we distributed about 200, 250 of those filters. And so one of those filters will give clean water to a family for a year, give or take.
And just to jump in, that's sort of a stopgap because obviously clean water in large volumes is being supplied by the UN, UNHCR, and other agencies. But this sort of helps fill in gaps where people can't get to that large scale water and they need something.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's not the major answer, but anyway.
And I don't know, everybody kind of asks how the answers are going to come, but honestly, when we were out there's a lot of political disagreement going on how to handle these refugees, as far as like they don't want them to get established in this area. And obviously, it's not a great area for them to try and be established. All the time that they put into creating wells and latrines is now kind of awash because of the flooding. There's just a lot of problems without a lot of answers. So whatever we can do to kind of ease that, or at least make it less of an issue, is what I try to do.
You, Tyler, are part of a team that's going out there. What is that team like? Like, what kind of expertise do you have on it?
So when I put this team together, like how I discussed before, my initial goal was to hike deep into these camps. I wanted to get some healthy young people with experience dealing with emergency medicine. Just you never know what you're going to kind of face out there or what you're going to find when you hike deep into these camps. So I put together a team of nurses. There's four nurses, a doctor, a drone. At the time, I'd had a drone expert, which we use drones on our team a lot. I think drones are an incredible resource for NGOs.
How do you use them?
How I was planning to use them is out there at that camp, we get the drone airborne and we can locate the best way to extricate a patient. So, like the safest pathway out, as well as a good place to meet up with those major groups, like so they have an ambulance and we would get in touch with them and say, we'll meet you at this part of the camp and we'll use a drone to identify how we would get the patient out on that Stokes wheeler.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I can't speak highly enough about our drones and how much I use them.
So you need a drone person to operate that, as well
Exactly.
as the medical personnel.
Yep. Medical, a doctor, four nurses. Me, I do nursing as well as firefighting and EMS, so I can kind of plug myself in where I need to be. And then a photographer. And I think Andrew would agree to this fact. I think people like me, I'm good at kind of helping people. I'm good at being active and involved, but I'm not the best at kind of inspiring other people. I think if you can get someone like a photographer, or someone with social media skills, someone that's articulate, that can write up a nice piece, can show some good pictures, and inspire the public to be involved, to kind of see how terrible this situation is, that makes a huge difference. And I think, us taking photographers on all of our missions kind of allows us to paint the picture of just how bad it is, how desperately, we need donations, how desperately we need people to be involved.
Now, when you go there, presumably you are not the only group of helpful people from abroad. How do you
Yeah.
work with the other groups? Like, who else do you encounter there, and how do you all work together?
So I think with a group like ours, incorporating is vital. You don't want to go out there and just be, like a lone wolf, a free rider, someone that just goes out and does stuff. We have to track what types of diseases we have. We have to know which hospitals we're sending them to. There are different hospitals for different diseases. There's labor and delivery areas, there's diphtheria, there's so you have to incorporate into the system that's already in place, like Andrew described. You have to get in contact with all these people. You make your connections right away. So that last trip out, I was able to kind of meet people, meet groups. They have meetings every week called health cluster meetings, where you go over that and you discuss that. And then it's up to us to kind of fit into what they have in place, as opposed to we do what we want and trend, they have to figure out how to incorporate with us. So we just kind of find our niche and make sure that we kind of plug ourselves into the framework that's already existing.
Somebody once asked me, like, well, how do you guys decide where to go? And it's like, well, we actually don't decide. We're invited. We're either invited by an agency or a local government, or invited by a hospital or doctors. And we also try to work, and in most cases do work, with local agencies and local groups that are from the region. So in this particular case, we're working with an organization called Do Well. And that actually means it's a flower. Actually, it's a description of a flower in Bangladesh. But we're working with a local group so that we are creating some sort of sustainable, continual effort. And we don't have the resources to be there every month, but we work with this group to see what their needs are and what the needs are on the ground. And we actually are permitted to work in Bangladesh through this organization. And this organization is going to help us working with them both in Cox's Bazar, which is the major refugee camp, and also in Dhaka, which is the capital of Bangladesh. There's something like 19 million people there. It's one of the world's largest cities, and there are many refugees. Bangladesh, before refugees got there, had many issues.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So we're interested in helping, and we're not particularly focused on one group over the other, whoever needs our help, medically speaking.
You're listening to the Radio Cafe. We're going to take just a quick break right now to hear from our sponsors. The Santa Fe Opera is launching its 62nd season with a spectacular musical journey that features two lovers in search of the best of all possible worlds. Candide is Leonard Bernstein's 20th century masterpiece. On stage at the Santa Fe Opera for the first time, on opening night, and nine more performances over the course of the summer. To learn more, visit santafeopera.org, where you can find out about all the different operas and purchase tickets. That's santafeopera.org. And now back to our program. When you find yourself in these refugee camps, what are the demographics? I mean, is it old, young, men, women, children? What kind of, is there a disproportionately high number of any particular group?
Yeah, because of the situation where, I mean, these people were basically thrown out of their country and massacred. A lot of the men, anywhere from teens up, are not there. They were killed, they were arrested. So there's a lot of orphan children. There's a lot of kind of makeshift orphanages. There are a lot of children, but women, children, and elderly people are disproportionate now because of the fact that there was a conflict and there was so much killing of the men, which is unfortunate. And you'll see, I don't know how far I should go into some of this, but you see some pretty sad things just kind of how they were treated, or just kind of gives you a perspective on how horrible it was. We saw a lady that we were treating. She had blisters and burns all up and down her arms. They would set their villages and houses on fire and then throw babies into the burning houses, and she had tried to reach in to get her child. So we were bandaging her arms from that situation. So, I mean, just we would hear 1,000 horrific stories every day and, treat the wounds that kind of just verify how bad it was.
And of course, there are also mental health needs that are extreme under those conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these children have. Everyone there has just been through so much. They've, there isn't anyone in those camps that hasn't lost numerous loved ones. Literally, we got there, it feels like everybody's kind of on the verge of tears. And the more we speak to people and the more we hear, the more we would find ourselves on the verge of tears as well. Just, it's a really heartbreaking situation. It's super unfortunate.
You mentioned about mental health issues. And so, back when we were working on the Syrian border in Jordan, we had a trauma acupuncture team to assist with mental health issues. Sadly, we have not brought mental health practitioners yet to Bangladesh, but we plan on doing that in our future missions. And those are WHO approved techniques to treat mental health using acupuncture. It's a physical treatment for a mental health issue. It is not necessarily appropriate to be using psychotropic drugs and things that are not going to be affordable long term for these patients. But absolutely, the horrors that these people have seen, and mental health is a very big part of what the UN, UNHCR provide as well, though they provide primarily an allopathic approach using psychiatrists and psychologists, and they tend to term it medical first aid because you don't have necessarily long-term mental health practitioners available unless you are using local resources, which you can do through a referral system and also through sort of bolstering their techniques and improving the possibility of long-term mental health providers that are local, that are accustomed to the traditions and, local ways of talking to these people. So,
Are there any institutions that you saw that are providing some sense of normalcy, whether it be schools, religious organizations, things like that?
one of the frustrating parts about this is, like I was saying, a lot of times the political stuff is playing a big part into this. They don't want them to get comfortable because, they were trying to figure out what to do with them. The refugee camps isn't a long-term solution in anyone's eyes. The most recent thing I heard was they were going to send them back. One thing that was kind of disheartening was they would set up, really quickly. They're very resilient. They were starting to set up shops and market areas where they could sell things back and forth to each other. And a lot of times these market areas are where everybody goes to socialize. It kind of created, kind of replicated the life that they had before. And it was kind of great to see, kids could go and then they had access to little candies. It was kind of great to see. We were all kind of excited to see how happy the people seemed when they were hanging out in these kind of markets and stuff. And then I want to say 2 weeks into it, I can't remember that exact date, they bulldozed the markets because they didn't want them getting set up and comfortable. Like, a lot of times you would hear stories about people that wanted to come in and give financial donations. They wanted to help build sustainable structures. There was a group that we knew that I'd kind of just met at our hotel, and they wanted to send construction teams in and just build strong, livable structures. And the biggest problem with it is people want to create answers and want to make things well for these people, but there's just so much up in the air as far as government involvement. I think Turkey's involved now, and this is nothing new for the Rohingya. They've been kind of being bounced around between governments for a long time now. And this is just an exacerbation of that, to where it makes helping them even more difficult because no one wants to be accountable for these people. It's extremely frustrating on every level, because whatever answers we might find or whatever we try and do, you never know if they're even going to allow it, unfortunately.
Is the current United States administration affecting your work in any ways, one way or another?
No. I think the United States, from all of my involvement with charity stuff, I think one thing I'm super proud of is how active and involved the United States is in situations like this. I think our country is one of the forerunners in kind of helping, and we're, you know, it's just something that everywhere I go, I'm super proud of, is the United States is kind of known for wanting to make situations better. And we did have a lot of support and help from the local government. It's just until the politicians figure out how they want to handle this, no one is willing to kind of make a strong statement or take a stand on it. But our government's been fantastic.
The reason I was asking that is just because of what's happening on our own border now with people who are refugees from other countries and seeking asylum. And I just wondered if that kind of bled through into other things, but it sounds like not.
No, but it's also wild to kind of think how helpful we are overseas. But, you know, something like that just takes place. It's heartbreaking. And it's terrible on so many levels.
You know, you were asking earlier about, you know, and Tyler was talking about building major structures and making something more permanent. And the balance for these large government groups that create, you know, a refugee camp that holds 800,000 is that they're not going to put up bricks and mortar and make a permanent situation, because it's supposed to be a temporary fix. And so, you know, there's this balance of providing all of these people with resources that normally, when you build these resources, you build them to last and whatever. But this isn't even land that's officially belonging to the residents of these refugee camps. So there's this balance, and so you have really, really sturdy tents, but you're not putting up buildings. And this is the case all over the world, where these refugee camps can't be made. I mean, there's funding and restrictions based on that funding that doesn't create permanence, but creates as much of an impact to keep these people protected over what's supposed to be short term, but ends up being decades.
Right.
So it's a very interesting balance.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you've got the population of Albuquerque living in temporary shelters, and people like you go in, Global Outreach Doctors, and stay for, what is it, several weeks?
So we don't have the resources or the funding at this point to stay more than a couple weeks at a time, but this is our second trip and there'll be others. We want to emphasize that Global Outreach Doctors is not interested in sort of medical tourism, where we go once and that's it. We do the best we can with our limited resources to continue to provide care. And those agencies that have really large budgets can provide year-round care. At our stage, and with additional donations, hopefully we'll be able to provide longer care, longer-term care. But yes, we go for a few weeks, and we bring medical teams back. We figure out what our niche is, and then we continue that.
As far as our group, I think one positive is, like Andrew said, finding that niche. You know, we had the ability to kind of become an EMS service in the camps. You know, we had the ability. We don't have some of the constraints of these larger organizations. And as far as people, if people are interested in donating to us, they can know that we take every cent of that donation and make it extremely valuable. There's nothing going toward, you know, we're all volunteers. Nobody's getting paid. We find ways to make every penny stretch, and we are doing incredible things with the limited amount of donations we have. And sometimes that is kind of lost on some of those bigger organizations. So people that are interested in donating, I tell them our group is a fantastic place to do that, because you will know that 100% of your donations are going to make a big difference in lives. It's going directly to people that desperately need it.
And globaloutreachdoctors.org is the website where people can find out more. How do you, and how do all of the people who are on staff and who are going and spending that time, take care of themselves. Like, how do you take care of yourself while you're there and when you get back? Because presumably there is some danger, both medical and psychological danger and secondary trauma of going to places like this.
Yeah. You know, I think I was kind of talking to my wife about this idea, and I hope I can articulate this in a way that kind of makes sense, but I think a lot of times people get really caught up with what they don't have, and there's this desire to always have more. You're never satisfied. You always, you know, you have this car, you want a better car, you have, you know, this house, your neighbor has a bigger house. And I think on one side, we all get very concerned with our own things that we need. And in the same respect, you look at the internet and you're seeing constantly all these people and groups that need stuff, and you kind of get desensitized. I think people get more and more comfortable with the fact that the world is a really sad, desperate place at times. And for me, what keeps me going is I've gained the perspective that, like, I come back here and I have a healthy family. You know, I feel like I come back and I'm living like a king. I have a junky car that is more than enough, and I'm super, you know, grateful to have it. I feel extremely blessed every time I come back from these places. And rather than becoming like desensitized and comfortable with the world and the state it's at, I've become extremely unsatisfied to the point where I want to do more and more. I'm constantly wanting to help. And, you know, I think if anything, being able to make that impact has made me happier. I feel like extremely blessed to live in the United States and to have a healthy, happy family. If anything, doing this work and being involved has made my mental well-being far better. Like, being involved and learning to be selfless, learning to care about other people, and learning that, like, being involved and active is more than just hitting like or sharing a story on Facebook. Like, I feel really good about what I'm doing and the impact I'm making. And I think that perspective, if anything, if you have problems right now or you're sad with your life, I would say getting involved and active in this stuff is the way to help your mental well-being. You
right,
know, like
right.
Thinking about others and helping others is going to actually improve it.
Do you have anything to add to that, Andrew? Because you've been at this work for quite a while yourself.
You know, obviously, Global Outreach Doctors has brought medical team members that have been overwhelmed with what they've seen. And, you know, you don't have a perfect batting average. And so some, you know, not the majority, but some just are overwhelmed on just a mental health level. And though we do our best to sort of alert them as to what they're going to see if they haven't done this before, there have been times when doctors and nurses have had to leave. On a physical level, certainly, you know, various preventative vaccines and so on, you know, we always let our volunteers know that they have to be self-reliant and work in austere conditions and be aware of the conditions and research and self-help themselves as far as what they're going to need to be in these places. But obviously, you know, we work in areas that are war zones. You know, Tyler was on the front lines in Iraq with a medical team. They're wearing flak jackets and so on, and we work in places there's disease. And so clearly we have to be alert. We have to be very, very careful about normal things that people do that work in hospitals, but have to do it much more, like wash your hands very often and so on. Be aware of the need for protection like masks and gowns and things like that. And in a lot of these places we work, you know, it's a little bit chaotic and people potentially could sort of take some shortcuts. And so these are all the things that we try to prepare for. So as far as physical health, keeping ourselves in a place where we're well hydrated, where we don't forget to eat, you know, there's stories of people that are very, very experienced working in Haiti. You know, years ago, all of us have worked that earthquake and they sort of forgot their own nutrition. And these are experienced people and became dehydrated and a patient themselves. And the last thing you want to do is be an NGO resource that strains the system because you just created another patient. That's not why you go there. So it's super important for us to be aware, to keep our volunteers healthy and for them to be self-reliant and aware of their own needs. You can't treat other people if you're sick.
So Tyler, you are on your way right now. You're just getting ready to go to Bangladesh and you'll be back several weeks after that. Is there anything else that both of you want to let people know before we go?
I just want to put out there that, as Mary Charlotte said, globaloutreachdoctors.org, we're a small NGO. We certainly could use anybody's help in donations or other resources to provide for this refugee mission or any future missions.
And I would like to tell people, like with the life straws, with all the things, we're constantly looking for ways to help people and get involved. And if there's people that are listening that see these things on the internet or on Facebook and want to do something more than just share the story or click like, we have chances to get involved. We have ways to change lives and to help people. And we, I think, would encourage people, like I said, over here in the United States, we're extremely fortunate. We have things very well. And one of my favorite quotes is, "Live simply so that others may simply live." Give up a Starbucks coffee. $20 can give a family water for a year. Like, give up some small things and change some lives, Get involved and help people.
Tyler Jones is Vice President of Operations for Global Outreach Doctors. He's a nurse and a fireman here in the Santa Fe area. Dr. Andrew Lustig is founder and president of Global Outreach Doctors. Once again, globaloutreachdoctors.org. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thanks
Hey,
for
thanks
having
for
us.
having us.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.